All right. This painting here is called the Wen Hastin Doom. You can't see it very well there, but I wanted to start with that one so you could see where it was positioned in the church. There's a bit of a better shot of it. It dates back to the late Middle Ages, probably the 15th century. It was painted most likely by a monk, an English monk, and hung in a church in Wen Hastin, Suffolk, England, in the county of Suffolk, England. And it just happens to form the setting of our murder mystery. Have you been reading it? Yeah? Okay. In fact, I'm supposed to give the sermon, but I'm going to do some shameless promotion here of our event coming up next weekend, Saturday, 7:30 at the Winkler Library. We're going to be discussing this book, and we have Dr. Michael Paul, coming to lead us in this discussion. So if you haven't read it, you might want to borrow my copy. Although we're not quite done, so we'll need... You might want to quickly... you've got a copy, okay? And apparently, if you're good on the internet, you could steal a movie version of it. There's a BBC production of it. Anyways, next week. So in our book... the book takes place at St. Anselm's College, the murder mystery. And this college is very lucky to own one of these. It's called a Doom. A picture of the final judgment. And in fact, P.D. James, the author of this lovely book, drops a few hints that the Doom referred to in this book is a fictionalized version of this one. The Wen Hastin Doom. Who will gain ownership of this painting when St. Anselm's College is closed? And will the painting be sold? And if it's sold, for how much? And who will pocket the money? And more importantly, do the answers to these questions have anything to do with the death of Ronald Treves, student of St. Anselm's? Son of a scandalously wealthy Sir Alfred Treves. Are you ready to borrow a copy? Before turning to my message, I want to look at this painting a bit more closely. I'm actually going to read a section here. P.D. James is going to help us. Okay, here they are. They were facing a vivid depiction of the Last Judgment. Here it is. Painted on wood, the hole shaped in a half moon with a diameter of about 12 feet. At the head was the seated figure of Christ in glory. I think we can get him. There he is. And there we've got Mary and John the Baptist. And he's sitting on a rainbow. I'm not quite sure why, but he's sitting on a rainbow, holding out his wounded hands over the drama below. The central figure was obviously Saint Michael. Who's this guy holding the sword? Apparently he's in charge of God's army of angels, according to Revelations. And there he is with the heavy sword in his right hand. And in his left he's dangling scales in which he was weighing the souls of the righteous and the unrighteous. Can you see the scales there? Apparently that's a soul. And he is... I guess this is the good stuff, and this is the sin stuff. And this list here is apparently all the bad things that this soul has done. You see, and this fellow here is actually the devil. Let's get to him. Okay, beside them... Hold on, let's back up. To his left, the devil, with a scaly tail, grinning jaws, the personification of horror, is prepared to claim his prize. Aha. These folks here in the back are just coming out of their graves. And they're hoping, they're praying there, I think. They're hoping to get away from this creepy guy there. Okay. Now, what else can we get? The virtuous are lifting pale hands in prayer. The damned were a squirming mass of open-mouthed hermaphrodites. Huh. Beside them, a group of lesser devils with pitchforks and chains were busily shoving their victims into the jaws of an immense fish with teeth like rows of swords. Let's find them. Oh, no, not there. That's heaven. Oh, my. There we are. These guys are getting it. There's the fish with the bad as hell. These are lesser demons. And they're trying to get them in there. Into the fish. Okay. To the left, heaven is depicted as a hotel of sorts. Where's the hotel? There it is. Hotel of sorts. St. Peter in Cope and Triple Tiara was receiving the more important of the blessed. Let's find him too. There's St. Peter. And see, of course, you've got the king gets in first. And this, I think, is a bishop and a cardinal. And the queen, she has to wait till the end here, but she'll get in. St. Peter is there, welcoming everybody home. All were naked, but still wearing the accoutrements of rank. A cardinal in his scarlet hat, a bishop in his mitre, a king and queen both crowned. There was little democracy about this medieval vision. The doom... I wonder if I've got a... I'll go back. Let's get this one up there. There. The doom was designed to terrify medieval congregations into virtue and social conformity. Literally, through the fear of hell. In fact, this part here is Romans 13, I believe. So there's some text there to remind you that you should obey your rulers. Okay. Now it was viewed by interest by academics or modern visitors for whom the fear of hell no longer had any power. Okay, can you imagine hanging one of these at the front of our church right there? Welcome here, everyone. Can you imagine using it to terrify churchgoers into behaving as good Christians should? For such purposes, such paintings have almost completely lost their power. They don't move us. They're interesting. Strange, even a little comical. But they don't do what they were supposed to do, at least not anymore. As Rudolf Bultmann has argued, us moderns, or postmoderns if you prefer that, can no longer believe in a three-tiered universe with heaven up in the clouds, humans here on earth, and the fires of hell burning inside the earth. And unlike many in the ancient world, we aren't really troubled by the afterlife. Hell is a topic, I don't know, it's probably more taboo than sex or money. I'm not even sure if my kids know what the word hell normally means. In fact, as I was flipping through these slides, Kate was asking me questions, what is that thing? I said, the devil. What's the devil? I don't know. We don't really talk about this sort of thing. Seems to me that if heaven and hell are anything for us, they're a metaphor, a way of speaking about something that we can't really speak about. They're not physical places to spend eternity, places where the time clicks by with the hands of the clock, where streets are gold and flesh can burn while never quite burning up. Heaven for us might mean something like finding the presence of God, and hell something like falling into God's absence. But as P.D. James points out here, in our age the threat of hell has largely lost the power to motivate. Well, in Winkler perhaps this is overstatement. But for those of us who have tried to share the gospel outside of this holy city, say in a secular university, in a philosophy seminar, or maybe at a Jets game or at a business meeting with some good secular city folk, we'll find here in Bultmann's idea something important. The fear of hell or even the anxiety about life after death has largely disappeared. For years, our fellowship group in Winnipeg had the pleasure of having a wonderfully cynical atheist as a member. I clearly remember a conversation we all had with him about the so-called afterlife. Heaven, he argued, sounded completely boring. And hell, that's ridiculous. You mean your decomposed body will be put back together so it can burn forever and ever? Come on. Really? Or bowing before God, saying, holy, 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 for eternity? No thanks, he said. When I die, I just want to die and be buried. End of story. Your good news isn't much of Good news, I can picture him saying. Now, our text today comes from the mouth of Martin Luther. From Ephesians 2, but I think of it as Luther's words. Ephesians 2 says, "By grace you have been saved through faith." This is the verse of all verses. It's the center of the Protestant tradition, the key, according to Martin Luther, that unlocks all of the sacred scriptures. And here I am, my first sermon, and I'm stuck with it. And it bothered me all week long. My week off, mind you. What bothered me this time around, however, was not the age-old battle between faith and works. Are we saved by what we do? Or because of what we believe, by God's work or our work, or by some combination of the two? Paul versus James. Some of you might know that discussion. Nope, what bothered me this time was the idea of being saved at all. The good news for Paul and Luther is that we are saved. It's gospel. Christianity is supposed to preach a message of salvation. But whether we're saved by faith or saved by works, what exactly are we being saved from? For Luther, the answer to this seemed pretty clear. Luther, unlike many of us and many of those who are lost today, lived in a world captivated by this, the doom. Now, it's no secret that prior to Luther's great discovery, he feared judgment and hell with an intensity that is almost unintelligible to us. While in the monastery, he was notorious for spending up to 6 hours a day in confession, prompting his spiritual mentor to complain that Luther, quote, called every fart a sin. Pardon the expression. Luther, as a typical medieval Christian, believed that every sin in order to be absolved had to be confessed. The soul had to be searched, the memory examined, motives weighed. Luther would check himself against lists of commandments and vices, inspecting himself constantly to see if traces of envy, lust, anger, pride, etc., 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 had wandered into his mind. What's more, to help purge himself from guilt and to make amends for his great sins, Luther fasted for days, sometimes without eating a crumb. He'd sleep without blankets on the coldest of winter nights. He'd spend hours venerating sacred sites and holy objects, all in an attempt to secure favor with God and to get freedom from guilt. Luther writes, "I was a good monk. I kept the rule of my order so strictly that I may say that if ever a monk got to heaven by his monkery, it was I. If I kept on any longer, I should have killed myself with vigils, prayers, readings, and other work." Christianity for Luther was hard work, all-consuming work, terrifying work, with no guaranteed payoff, no assurance of salvation. Here again, we are somewhat astounded. Luther's guilt is almost as foreign to us as doom's hell. We don't really speak that language. I mean, maybe a murderer or a pedophile or a war criminal might feel this. Maybe. And yet here's Luther, a boring man with boring sins, overwhelmed with guilt. Saved from sin, saved from guilt, from judgment, by grace alone, with no human effort, for Luther this was good news. Great news. But is it good news for us? Is it good news outside of the Bible Belt and inside the secular world? I can easily think of a dozen of my non-Christian friends who would simply not relate to Luther's feelings of guilt here at all. Sure, they mess up now and then, but they don't intend to harm anybody. They're generally good people with good intentions. Does the message of grace alone still have the power to save them? To even interest them? For those with no real concern about the afterlife, no real sense of guilt, what power can Luther and Paul's salvation message offer? What are you trying to save me from anyway? I can almost hear my friends asking. And I ask you as well, what are grace and faith saving us from? What is the good news in this? We could easily move now to a discussion of our world. There's much to be saved in it. We could paint our own doom up here, in front of the church, with images of our own hell.
terrorism, civil war, child soldiers, racism, homophobia, violence against women, child poverty, family breakdown. We could paint some sort of collage up there. If we raise a little hell up into this world, into the here and now, I think we could see it. Hell is real. It's lived. It should probably be painted at the front of our church. Right there, to terrify us week by week into doing something. Surely we need God's grace to save the world from this sort of hell. We need God's gift of faith to believe that these things could change, to believe that this world could be healed, if only in part. But I think there's something more personal involved here too. In this little book, The Courage to Be, Paul Tillich suggests that the gospel has always offered to save us from our inner experience of hell too, to save us from anxiety. More specifically, to save us from three kinds of anxiety. Our anxiety over death, our anxiety over guilt, and our anxiety over meaninglessness. Each of these three, he argues, is present in every person, in every age, in every era, with one form of anxiety playing a dominant role. In the Middle Ages, anxiety over guilt took center stage, as we see with Luther. Among the ancients, the anxiety over death and fate was predominant. But what of now? If all three types of anxiety remain, which one is predominant for us? Well, according to Tillich, ours is an age consumed with the anxiety of meaninglessness. We've lost a sense of direction, lost our greater purpose. Ours is the age of boredom, of binge watching, of all-inclusive holidays, credit cards, and internet shopping. We've tried everything and have found that nothing satisfies. We've tried everything and we've found that it all signifies nothing. As our Ephesians text puts it, we have followed the desires of the flesh, the passions of our senses, the course of our world, and we have found ourselves dead. Living, but dead. What must we be saved from? Here and now in the 21st century? Emptiness. Boredom. A life without meaning, a life without purpose. The good news we must bring to the world and cling to ourselves is that our lives and our world is layered with meaning, with divine beauty, with truth, with holy mystery. The good news is that what we do today, tomorrow, and in every day to come matters. We are part of God's great narrative, given a daily opportunity to join with God in transforming ourselves and transforming our world. A daily opportunity to do those good works that, as our text says, we were created to do. A daily opportunity to seek out the mysteries of God, to marvel at the beauty of nature, music, and art, to be overwhelmed by the wonder of it. I'm not exactly sure what this means for all of you. For me, I think it means starting my day with a different mindset, with eyes open to the daily opportunities set before me. I have not just to teach a curriculum, but to participate in God's mission of transformation. To encourage a student who's struggling. To befriend a colleague who seems on his own. To identify the gifts and talents of my children. To be gracious and loving towards my wife. To chisel away at my pride and my stubbornness and selfishness, to take time to read, to think, meditate, to walk our country road slowly, with enough time to pray, to wander at the hills and the sunflower fields. Every day is meaningful. Every day matters. So what are the takeaways here? What should we leave this service with, or this sermon with? The first has to do with mission, I think. I think we need to recognize up front that many in our world have no fear of this and no clear sense of guilt. When Hastings' doom and Luther's guilt are interesting, but not as compelling as they once were. Preaching the old salvation message to the lost might not be enough. Secondly, I think that people in our world still need saving. We need saving. We are empty. We are bored. We lack direction. We're filled with anxiety. We need salvation. Thirdly, I think the power of the gospel today is its ability to save us from this emptiness, to grasp us with an ultimate concern, with a sense that what we do and who we are really matters. Ephesians tells us that we were created to do good works, to fight against the hell in our world, to transform ourselves and our world by the grace of God. It is by grace that you have been saved. Saved from hell? Yeah. Saved from guilt? Yeah. Saved from meaninglessness? Most definitely.